Welcome everyone to the first session of Understanding Monetary Chaos. I think we have a very good lineup for you for the course. I'll be talking in addition to my topic tonight on deflation, good and bad. Bob Murphy will be talking about the problem with aggregates, why the Austrian school has wisdom, and we'll have Tom DiLorenzo on the myth of the independence of the Fed, and Mark Thornton on who or what caused the financial crisis and the Great Recession. So it's an exciting lineup, and I'm anticipating a good thing from all the lecturers, and hopefully you'll enjoy it. So there's a bit of false advertising in my the title of my lecture this evening, Friedman versus Rothbard on the Great Depression. The reason being that Friedman and Rothbard never really squared off an actual debate on this topic. In fact, Friedman, as we'll see, did his best to ignore Rothbard. But what we'll do tonight is look at a sort of a secondary debate that went on between two other people that were on these issues. One side took the position of Rothbard, and the other took the position of Friedman. So let's get started here with the lecture, and I'll be depending on these. There are quite a few figures and statistics that I'll be citing, and you know they'll be up on the screen for you to see. So the books that are involved are by Friedman and Schwartz. That's their famous book on a monetary history of the United States. It was published in 1963. It took the economics profession by storm, and pretty much everyone today, including and especially the former Fed chair, Ben Bernanke, accepts much of Friedman and Schwartz's, and others refer to it as Friedman's story about the Great Depression. And it was this book that brought that about. Prior to the publication of the Friedman-Schwartz book, the explanation of the Great Depression was very Keynesian. Friedman changed this to some extent. It was still a macroeconomic explanation, meaning it depended on aggregates, the money supply, the price level, the level of wages, total output in the economy, all of these aggregates. It really didn't penetrate to what Austrian economists like to call the individual prices and markets that are so important in the operation of the economy. Rothbard, in the same year, wrote a book known as America's Great Depression. I think it's a wonderful book. It's the best explanation of the Great Depression, at least the U.S. aspect of it. Another book you might want to look at is The Great Depression, which deals with the Great Depression in Great Britain and with some of its worldwide aspects, and that's by Lionel Robbins, now called Lord Robbins. And that was published back in 1935. But in any case, Rothbard published the follow-up book to that, which came out posthumously after his untimely passing in 1995. He had all the essays already written. We put it together in a book, which I edited, and it's called The History of Money and Banking in the United States, the Colonial Era to World War II. And what's very different about Friedman's book and Rothbard's book is that the first sentence of Friedman's book says something like, this is the history of the U.S. money supply, as if an aggregate, a made-up average, can actually act. So he talked about his book as a history of the money supply, whereas Rothbard, in contrast, in both of his books, he focused on the actors, the people who were manipulating the money supply, the people who were being affected by this, the people who favored certain policies, and the people who were against them. So for Rothbard, history always dealt with people, even when you were talking about economic events. For Friedman, it dealt explicitly, as I said in the first sentence of the book, he tells you this, with aggregates, statistical constructs. So those are the important books that you could be consulting if you have any deeper questions about this topic. Let's go to the next slide. Okay, what was Friedman's story? That is, how did he explain the Great Depression? And we can sum that up in four bullet points. His view was that the 1920s was a very prosperous decade for the U.S., and consumer prices were stable. So for Friedman, there was no inflation in the 1920s. Both wholesale prices and consumer prices possibly even declined slightly during that period. Then in 1929, inexplicably, what Friedman called a garden variety recession occurred. And according to Friedman, it was a mild recession. It would have ended within a year or a little bit more had the Fed not made a huge error. According to Friedman, the huge error that the Fed made was to contract or reduce the money supply by 25% between the years of 1929 and 1933. And according to Friedman and Schwartz, this sent the economy into a tailspin. It's this aspect of Friedman's story, the great deflation supposedly engineered by the Fed, that most economists today accept, including and especially, as I said, Fed economists like Ben Bernanke. So according to Friedman, it was Fed negligence that caused the Great Depression. In fact, he's on record as saying that if the Fed had never existed, we wouldn't have had a Great Depression. But from his point of view, we wouldn't have had a Great Depression because the Fed, there would have been no Fed to engineer or orchestrate a reduction in the money supply. The Austrians would say, of course, say the same thing, including Rothbard, that if the Fed had never existed, we would have never had a Great Depression, but for different reasons, as we'll see, which brings us now to the Rothbard story. So Rothbard points out, and I think Friedman would agree with this, and does agree with this, that the 1920s had tremendous technological progress. There was a tremendous amount of capital investment in the economy. We had refrigeration coming in, electricity, radios, mass assembly of automobiles, vacuum cleaners were introduced. We had a tremendous increase in the supply of goods. So if you've taken any economics, you know that if supply increases and all other things are equal, then in fact prices have to fall. In order to sell all these extra goods and services that were coming on the market in the 1920s, if there was the same amount of money in the economy, prices would have gone down, and they would have gone down by a great deal. But in fact, they didn't, as we saw. Prices were pretty stable for the entire period. So that meant that the Fed must have offset this natural inclination or this natural tendency for prices to fall during prosperity. And in fact, as Rothbard points out, from 1922 through 1928, the Fed increased the money supply by 6 to 7% per year. Now we'll talk about Rothbard's definition of the money supply and objections put by the monetarists a little bit later. So this increase in the money supply, while it may not have increased prices, it did increase them above the level that they would have been, the much lower level that they would have attained without the increase in the money supply. But it didn't increase them from the year before. In any case, what it did do was to cause a real estate boom and of course, a stock market boom. So it increased the prices on assets markets, which monetarists and other mainstream economists tend to ignore when they try to tell a story about what causes recession. This inflationary boom then resulted in a recession of 1929. Now, Rothbard would agree with Friedman that this recession would have been pretty mild and would have ended pretty quickly if it had not been for the Fed, okay, and not just the Fed. In fact, the Fed tried to reflate, that was the term used, reflate the economy to push prices back up to the level that they enjoyed during the inflationary boom. And that was one reason recession was prolonged and turned into a Great Depression. The second reason, which we're not going to cover as much here, was the fact that both President Hoover's and then FDR's policies were aimed at preventing a necessary fall in prices and wages that would have adjusted prices and wages to the reduced money supply. So that's Rothbard's story, and I'm sticking to it. I'm a Rothbardian on these matters. And that's Friedman's story. Now, as I said, they never clashed over this. In other words, they never directly debated one another. Rothbard certainly attacked many of Friedman's positions on the Great Depression, but Friedman never really responded. His strategy seemed to be to ignore Rothbard and just hope no one else read Rothbard or became familiar with his own explanation. So let's move on to the next slide. Having a technical difficulty here, which here we go. So now the modern debate took place between a famous monetarist economist and the guy on the right who looks like Al Pacino, if you ask me, but actually it's me. But in any case, Richard Timberlake is the monetarist. He was a student of Friedman at the University of Chicago. He's an eminent monetary economist. And then there was me, okay, who responded to an article that he had written, or a series of articles that he had written. And those articles appeared in the Freeman, which is a popular magazine, but had very good free market articles in it. Now, as I mentioned, Timberlake wrote a series of three articles in which he criticized Rothbard's interpretation of the Great Depression. Okay, and he did so from a monetarist viewpoint. Now, I responded. I was asked by the editor at the time, Sheldon Richman, to respond to Timberlake's criticisms of Rothbard, and I was happy to do that, and I did that later in 1999. And then there was another round of the debate in 2000, which we really won't touch on as much. It didn't deal with the issues that were as substantive as the issues dealt with in 1999. So what were the issues? Well, there are a number of claims that Richard Timberlake made regarding Rothbard. For example, he said that Rothbard used an old and unacceptable definition of inflation, and that he also contrived a definition of the money supply that was really used, or that was done to make the 1920s appear to be an inflationary decade, okay? That is a definition of the money supply that Richard Timberlake himself did not hold and that most monetarists did not hold, but that Rothbard held. So according to Timberlake, it was deliberately contrived so that you could make the 1920s appear to be inflationary, at least from the point of view of increases in the money supply. The claim was also made by Timberlake that Rothbard mismeasured certain data that the Fed put out and therefore was led to misjudge the 1930s as an inflationary decade. Now remember, Friedman and the monetarists claimed that the 1930s was a deflationary decade and that the Fed had engineered the deflation and this had brought about the Great Depression. So Rothbard was saying the exact opposite, in fact, as we'll see, that in fact it was at least partly, the Fed's attempts to reflate the money supply, to expand the money supply during the 1930s, the early 1930s, that prolonged what would have been a short recession and turned it into a Great Depression. Finally, the claims made by Timberlake that Rothbard did not understand the operation of the interwar gold standard. So what I'll do is I'll deal with each of these criticisms in turn. Let's talk about how Rothbard defined inflation. He defined it as the increase in the money supply, and I'm quoting him now, as you can see on the slide. He defined inflation as the increase in the money supply not consisting in, that is, not covered by an increase in gold. That is, if paper money increased more than gold did, then according to Rothbard, that itself constituted inflation, regardless of what happened to prices, regardless of whether prices rose or stayed constant or even fell. As long as the increase in money substitutes, that is bank deposits and banknotes, exceeded the increase in the amount of gold in the economy, then you had inflation. So according to Timberlake, this was a new and unacceptable definition. Okay, that's what he called it, claiming that Rothbard just made it up. But as we'll see, this was actually the original definition of the term inflation, which came into use in the mid-19th century. Now, it was developed by the so-called British Currency School. They were a hard money school that got involved in a debate with the British Banking School, which was sort of an inflationary school. And this debate took place in Great Britain, hence the name British. And as we'll see, it was decided, in, at least the debate itself, in favor of the British Currency School. So initially, their definition of inflation, which was Rothbard, prevailed. So contrary to what we're told by Timberlake, the term inflation is not a newfangled term contrived to make the 1920s appear inflationary. It was the original meaning of the word inflation. So let me just talk about the theory, and there's a kind of a jumble of symbols there in red. Don't worry about them yet. I'll explain them shortly. The British Currency School used that definition that I quoted from Rothbard of inflation in explaining its business cycles and business cycles. Okay, now as Mises pointed out, Ludwig von Mises, the British Currency School is really the first school to have a well worked out theory of the business cycle. It wasn't completely correct, but it moved along the correct line. Okay, it was a correct first step to the Austrian theory of the business cycle. So what was their theory? Okay, very shortly, because I don't want to spend too much time on this. What the British Currency School said was that if the Bank of England, which was the sort of quasi-central bank at the time, increased the amount of banknotes and deposits, then what would happen, and now you can look at the jumble of red symbols there, there would be an increase. Now, any arrow going sideways indicates that is causes something, okay? So the increase in unbacked notes and deposits using the definition quoted by Rothbard automatically meant that there would be an increase in the money supply because these notes and deposits were not backed by gold. And that means that there would be inflation. Now, when the money supply increased as a result of this issue of paper money, the domestic prices, and that's an upward arrow means an increase, there will be an increase in the price in domestic prices, P sub D. And that would be greater than, suddenly, world prices. So with domestic prices now higher because of the inflation of the money supply than world prices, naturally what would happen would be that goods in Great Britain would become more expensive, so exports would fall. And so you see a downward arrow there on next to X. X represents exports. At the same time, British residents, you know, they're rational. They don't want to buy higher priced British goods. They would increase their imports from France, Germany, and elsewhere, the U.S. So you'd have an increase in imports, a fall in exports as a result of this inflation that drove prices up in your own country. And that would mean a balance of payments, BOP, deficit. Okay? In other words, you'd be spending more money on foreign goods than foreigners would be spending on your goods. Now, under a gold standard, the only way to pay for those excessive foreign goods that you're purchasing is through gold. They don't want your paper pounds or your paper bank, your bank deposits, which are in terms of pounds. They use their own currencies, the franc, the mark, U.S. dollar. So you would have to send them gold, which means if you get to the next arrow, that would cause a fall in gold reserves. The people who want to purchase these extra goods would then have to go to the banks and also the Bank of England, turn in their notes and deposits for gold. And under a gold standard, the banks are legally mandated to pay out gold anytime people come in and demand it in exchange for deposits or notes. Once gold reserves began flowing out of the country, the domestic public would become worried. And they would begin, there would be a fear of bank runs. Banks would begin to worry that, you know what, if people think that we don't have enough gold to pay off their deposits and their notes, then what's going to occur is that people are going to rush into the banks and attempt to get their gold out. And since, of course, it was fractional reserve banking, they didn't have sufficient amount of gold to cover the demands for gold. So that would cause them then, fearing bank runs, what they would do is the banks themselves would start lending less, okay? They would call in their loans, they would cut their lending, which means that would cut the money supply. So the money supply would fall, and as a result, you would have a recession. That was the British currency school theory of inflation and recession. And it explained the cycle, explained the increase in money supply, explained inflation, and then the gold outflow explained the fall in the money supply, or the contraction of the money supply, and the recession. Now, that's not the Austrian theory, but it has some of the essential elements of the Austrian theory in it. It's a very good theory to begin with, especially for the mid-19th century. So what was their policy? Okay. Well, their policy was really hard money. They said that changes in the money supply, and I'll always use in these slides MS to represent money supply, should only occur as a result of inflows or outflows of gold. That is, if gold flows into the economy and people begin to deposit in the banks, yes, then it's fine and non-inflationary to have an increase in the money supply. But they went on, the money supply should never increase because of an increase in the issue of unbacked notes and deposits. So only when gold is increasing in the country should there be an increase in the money supply. They went further than that. They said that the issue of additional notes and deposits should only occur, or let me just rephrase that, should be always to be equal to the dollar for dollar or pound for pound, that's the pound symbol there, increases in the gold stock to be the balance of payments. Okay, so if you take a state in the United States today, let's say California, the money supply in California only increases if they have a balance of payments surplus, that is, they sell more to the rest of the country than they receive, than they buy from the rest of the country. Then there'll be more dollars in California. The same applies to any state. Under the gold standard, the whole world is a currency area. So the currency school claimed that this should be the general rule, that just as it's the case for any town or any region in Great Britain, it should also be the case for all countries. That a non-inflationary policy is one in which there's only an increase in the money supply, dollar for dollar or pound for pound, with new gold flowing into the economy. So that was their policy. Okay, so let's look at this old definition of inflation which they used to develop their business cycle theory. Here's two definitions which you can look at. They're from currency school, American currency school followers. There was a sort of a version of the currency school in the United States at the same time. They were even harder core than their British cousins. But for example, Charles Holt Carroll, just read one of them, says instead of using gold and silver for currency, they are merely used as the basis of the greatest possible inflation by the banks, meaning that when gold and silver come in, they increase the amount of paper money, banknotes, and deposits by more than the amount of gold and silver that's flowing into the economy. He goes on to say we should prevent any artificial increase of currency to prevent a future catastrophe. And by that he means we should prevent any increase in the money supply beyond the amount of gold that we get. And if you look at Francis Walker, his definition, he refers to a permanent excess of circulating money of a country over that country's distributive share of the money of the commercial world, meaning that it was when gold flowed in that you got your share, your proper share of the money supply, which was the worldwide money supply, which was simply gold. So that was the old definition of inflation. So going on to the next slide, the currency school made an error. Even though they won the debate over the British of banking school, and their views were actually enacted into law, a law called Peel's Act, it failed to prevent recessions, okay, and inflation. Why was that? Because, unfortunately, the British currency school did not include bank deposits in their definition of money. They only included currency. So there was no law that limited the amount of increase in bank deposits. So you had inflations and you had recessions that resulted from increases in bank deposits. But yet the school was discredited because there were panics and crises during the rest of the 19th century. So eventually economists forgot about the currency school and they adopted the definition of the money supply that the British banking school believed in. And that definition basically said there's inflation whenever the money supply is greater than what we call, or what they call, the needs of trade. Okay. So that's a short step to the modern definition, okay, of inflation. So early American quantity theorists like Irving Fisher, who was sort of known as the father of the modern quantity theory, they developed a new definition of the money of inflation that was based on the British banking school's definition. Okay. And Edwin Kemmerer, who I quote there, was a follower of Irving Fisher. And what he said was that basically inflation was an increase in the money supply in excess of the trade needs. Okay, he no longer talked about gold. Okay, he talked about the needs of trade. He also, again, referred to inflation as an increase in currency relative to trade needs. Now, that's just a short step to the modern definition of inflation, which is held by Friedman, Timberlake, other modern economists. And that is any increase in prices, okay, caused by an excess of the money supply, and they use a more modern term, over the money demand. Okay, and that symbol, that rightward arrow is greater than, or for example, money supply is greater than the money demand. Okay. And by money demand, they basically mean the needs of trade. Okay, they're more, it was a little more sophisticated than the British banking school, but that's basically what they mean. So there we have it. Timberlake is wrong about Rothbard making up a new and unacceptable definition of inflation. All that means that he doesn't like Rothbard's definition of inflation. Okay. And he's wrong when he says that it's new. It was the original definition of inflation. So let's go on to the next point of contention between the two. Defining the money supply. Okay. Timberlake, was in favor of a definition of the money supply, M2, as it was defined before 1980. That was an official Fed statistic. Okay. Now, based on what he believed about the money supply, he objected to Rothbard including in his definition two things. Okay. And I have them there in red, and I'll explain them. One is the savings and loan share accounts, and the second is life insurance policy reserves. Okay, Rothbard included both of them. And this is where, you know, it was alleged by Timberlake that Rothbard contrived this definition, okay, in order to make, quoting Timberlake, the rate of monetary growth appear larger than it actually was during the 1920s, unquote. So Timberlake goes on to deny that these assets are money because, quote, they cannot be spent on ordinary goods and services. And that part's true. As he says, to spend them, one needs to cash them in for other money, checking, deposits, or currency. But as we'll see, that's not a definitive argument at all, because there are other things that are included that, and that Timberlake himself would include in the money supply that also need to be cashed in the sense of getting currency for them before you can spend them, or getting a checking account money for them before you can spend them. And that'll take us to the next slide. So what are savings and loan shares? Okay, they're called share accounts. Okay, and they're identical to savings deposits, which are included in the money supply figure that Timberlake favors. So savings and loans, okay, are obligated. Okay, now most of them collapsed, by the way, in 1989, 1990, because they mainly invested in mortgages, and there was a big collapse there was a sort of a slowing down of the housing market in 1989, 1990. Nothing like we had in 2005, but it was enough to drive most of the savings and loan industry into bankruptcy. But in any case, they had a legal obligation to repurchase their shares at par. Meaning if you had $5,000 of shares, you could turn them in on demand and get $5,000 in checking account money or in currency from the savings and loans. There was something in their bylaws, though, that said they could make you wait up to 30 days or more to cash in your share. But the exact same thing is true of savings deposits. Okay, so commercial banks and savings banks can also make you wait to withdraw your savings deposit. But neither savings and loans nor savings commercial banks or mutual savings banks, none of those ever invoked that clause. That clause hasn't been invoked since before the 1920s. Because if some bank were to invoke that clause to tell someone, you can't get your money out without 30 days notice, that there would be a bank run, and that bank would suddenly come under pressure. And so they would never do that. Okay. In fact, all of them say that you don't have to wait. Okay, they make that claim. You do not have to wait to cash in your savings deposits. Or when the savings and loans are active, your savings and loan shares. So a savings and loan share account is nothing different than a savings deposit. Which brings us to another point. And that point is that Timberlake doesn't object to Rothbard including savings deposits of what are called mutual savings banks, okay, in the money supply. Mutual savings banks, their savings deposits were not included in the money supply before 1980. They are after 1980. And that was, again, one of the reasons why Timberlake refused to include them and objected to Rothbard's including them. Okay, but also the word mutual means that these savings banks were mutually owned. There were no shareholders, there were no stockholders in mutual savings banks. They were owned by the depositors, just as credit unions are owned by the depositors. Okay. So mutual savings banks were no different than savings and loan associations. Right. And in fact, as we said, and I think I may have misspoken a moment ago, they were included in M2, and as I said, there was no opposition by Timberlake to including them. But yet, they were their savings deposits were nothing but really shares in ownership of the bank, just as the case of the mutual, as the savings and loan shares were also shares of ownership. But again, they were withdrawn on demand, and so there was no difference between the mutual savings banks and the savings and loan association. So why did Timberlake make any distinction? Okay, why did he oppose one, the one that Rothbard favored, including, and while he allowed the other? Okay, well, there's a reason for that, and that's because Friedman and Schwartz, who are his mentors as a monetary economist, they excluded these share accounts of savings and loans, but they didn't do so on economic grounds. Okay, on economic grounds, savings deposits in mutual savings banks, and share accounts in savings and loan associations are economically identical. You can go in at any time and you can withdraw them. In today's world, you can take them out, you can withdraw them through ATM machines. So there's no difference. But here's what Friedman and Schwartz said. They are, and you can look at the slide here, they are technically, that is, savings and loan associations, they are technically not banks as defined in accordance with the definition of banks agreed upon by federal bank supervisory agencies. Okay? So in other words, they're standing on a legal technicality. It has nothing to do with the essential economic identity between them. Okay? It's because some federal agency says that, well, you know, they're not technically really banks. Well, so what? I mean, mutual savings banks aren't really technically or mutual savings bank savings deposits aren't really technically savings deposits; they're really ownership shares. So that's very weak. It's a very weak argument against Rothbard. Okay. And here's just something I want to quickly allude to. There's a little digression. I don't want to spend too much time on this. So Timberlake did accept the money supply. The M2 figure that was one of the official figures that's well used quite a bit today as a measure of the money supply. Okay, it's an official figure of the Fed. But after 1980, that figure included savings and loan associations. Okay, but yet, writing in 1999, Richard Timberlake denied that these should be part of the money supply, even though the Fed itself included them. So I think that's pretty arbitrary on his part to criticize Rothbard when, in fact, even the Fed accepted these savings and loan shares as part of the money supply. And then here, and you can look at this later, is what Rothbard used as his money supply figure in America's Great Depression. Okay, I wrote something on it. I developed it a little bit further, and we call this the true money supply. Rothbard also wrote something on this in 1976, and so these are the items that we included in it. Okay, and that's not important right at this moment. You can look at that later on your own. What is important though is the criterion that was used, or the logic. So what Rothbard and I would claim is that for an item to be included in the money supply, or the monetary aggregate is sometimes called, it has to fulfill several criteria. So one, it must be routinely and universally accepted in exchange for all goods and services. Two, it must serve as the final means of payment in all transactions. So in other words, if you pay currency to someone, then that means that if you owe them $100, you pay them $100 in currency. Legally, you've fulfilled your obligation, you owe them nothing more. If you pay with a credit card, however, you still owe the bank who's giving you a credit card loan money. So a credit card is not included in the money supply. Currency is included in the money supply. Okay? But that seems to leave out everything else. But in fact, there's a third criteria. Okay? A thing must meet those first two criteria that we talked about. Okay? And that's basically currency. Or it must be, if you look at number three, instantly convertible claim to the general medium of exchange. That it must be a claim to currency that's instantly convertible, meaning that it must be interchangeable with the general medium of exchange in the U.S., that's U.S. Fed notes, the dollars that we carry around, on demand at face value. So that allows many other things to be included. Savings deposits, checking accounts, all of these things are included because they are a guaranteed claim, especially with the FDIC insurance and the Fed bailing out banks. They're a guaranteed claim to quantities of U.S. currency. Okay, and those dollars of currency are the final means of payment. So anything to recap, anything that is a final means of payment, like currency, or can be is interchangeable with it or convertible into it at par on demand, then it's part of the money supply. So if you have $5,000 in a savings deposit, you can go to, you can get $5,000 in cash out of an ATM machine or withdraw it in person at the bank. And so that's why it becomes part of the money supply. It gives you readily spendable dollars. And we're going to need that, keep that in mind when we talk about something more difficult. Why did Rothbard include life insurance policy reserves, and what does that even mean? Well, there's something called whole life insurance, okay? And what whole life insurance is, an insurance policy on your life, but it's also a savings deposit in the following sense. Your premiums exceed the amount that is needed to insure you against death, okay? Now, what happens to the excess premiums you pay? They go into what are called cash accumulation accounts, okay? And they're invested on behalf of the policyholder. And if you're a policyholder with a whole life insurance policy, then you then have a right to these cash accumulation accounts, okay? You can withdraw them on demand, okay? And you could in the 1920s, same way, by simply withdrawing them, writing an order to the insurance company to send you part of them, or some insurance companies would allow you to take out loans against them. So if you had $5,000 accumulated in a cash accumulation account, they would give you, if you wanted $2,000, they would give you a $2,000 loan. It's really your money they're giving back to you, okay? Or you could easily stop paying your premiums and allow the policy to lapse. And as soon as you stop paying your premiums, all the money that was in the accumulation account would revert to you, okay? So you would get it immediately. So that's Rothbard's reasoning for including life insurance policy reserves. Now, despite what Timberlake says, I mean, you know, Timberlake and the other monitors think this is ridiculous that Rothbard included it in a way that was, you know, was not above board. He included it simply to make the money supply increases in the 1920s appear really greater than they were. But in fact, I went and looked back at the 1960s and 1970s, and there were many economists, many Keynesian economists even, that included life insurance reserves or life insurance surrender values, they're sometimes called, in the money supply. So I just quote two here. One's name is Walter Haynes, and he wrote that life insurance companies are, quote, savings institutions, and reserves can be withdrawn at any time. Okay, those are his words, and are near money like bank savings deposits. So SD will always stand for savings deposits. Okay, just as MS stands for money supply. So he was saying that they're identical to savings deposits, which there are reasons, as we saw, a very good reason for including savings deposits in the money supply. You can cash them in immediately. Another economist named M.L. Burstein wrote that the life insurance policy cash value offered, quote, ready convertibility into cash and was, and this is quite an emphatic statement, quote, almost as liquid as a mattress full of currency. So he was saying that it's really not much different from just having a bunch of currency in your hands. And he said it's no less liquid than the savings and loan accounts, which we saw are really money, part of the money supply and should be, or government bonds, which Rothbard and I also included in our true money supply. Because if you own a government bond, you can easily, after holding for 6 months, you can withdraw the full amount of money plus interest by turning the bond in. Okay. So Timberlake was wrong on including the life in his criticisms of Rothbard, including both savings and loan share accounts and including life insurance policy reserves. Having said that, we did leave out these life insurance policy reserves, that is Rothbard did in his later writing and I did, when calculating the TMS, okay? But they are so controversial, and maybe some people don't think that they that these them of them as savings accounts or savings deposits that they can withdraw. We left them out. But I went back and recalculated the increase in the money supply in the 1920s, leaving out the life insurance policy reserves. And so what I found was, if you can see it there on the slide, when you included life insurance policy reserves, as Rothbard did, the money supply increased in the 1920s by 61%. From about mid-1921 through 1928. And that was an average of 8.1% per year, okay, very, very high. But if you exclude the reserves, which I did, and recalculated Rothbard's money supply figure in the 1920s, it turns out that the money supply increased by almost the same amount, 55%, and averaged on an annual basis 7.3%. Okay. So it doesn't change Rothbard's view of the 1920s as inflationary, given his definition, which followed the older currency school definition of inflation. So I think Timberlake was wrong there. Now, let me just say a few words about Timberlake's claim that Rothbard misinterpreted the Fed's monetary data. What Timberlake did in trying to figure out what the Fed's intent was, whether it was intended to be inflationary or deflationary in the 1930s, he took the whole monetary base, which is all the reserves, bank reserves in the economy, plus all the currency in the economy, and he subtracted out gold, the gold stock, because under a gold standard, the Fed has no control over the gold stock. When gold flows into the country and goes into the Fed legally must give dollars in the form of either currency or reserve deposits in exchange for the gold. Okay, so they don't. So that they have to do that if they're going to operate under the gold standard. So that's not something that they control. That's not part of the money supply that they have control over. Okay, so Timberlake calls that the net Fed, and he defines it as the monetary base minus GS, which is the gold stock. Okay, and he claims that this faithfully reflects Fed policy. That this faithfully, this figure tells us whether the Fed is trying to be inflationary or deflationary. Now he says that if you use this to see what the Fed's intentions were in the 1920s, from 1921 to 1929, the Fed's actions were deflationary during the 1920s. So he claimed that not only were prices constant, but the Fed itself was trying to deflate the economy. That was their intention, okay, by looking at that data. But while what he says about the gold stock is true, he leaves out two important influences on the money supply that are not controlled by the Fed, okay? And in fact, we teach these two influences in our, at least one of them rather, in our money and banking texts, in standard money and banking texts, and even in our basic macro courses. So first of all, currency, the amount of currency in circulation is not controlled by the Fed. The amount of currency in circulation is completely controlled by the public. So for example, during the Christmas shopping season, okay, during the holiday season that runs from, let's say, well, it's getting being extended all the time. But let's say it runs from around Thanksgiving through the middle of January. What people do is they go to their banks and they withdraw a lot of currency from the banks. And in doing so, their intention is to have more money to make small purchases and so on. So a lot of cash flows out of the banks. When that happens, and if you look at number two, you can see what the sequence of effects are. When that happens, the amount of currency in circulation goes up, and C stands for currency in circulation, and that causes a reduction in bank reserves. Suddenly, banks have less reserves because people have removed currency from the banks. And these are fractional reserve banks. So what they have to do is they have to cut back on their loans because they're losing reserves. They have to hold, let's say, in U.S., at least 10% of their deposits in the form of reserves. But as these reserves decrease, they have less and less money behind their deposits, and so therefore they have to cut their lending, reduce their checking deposits, CD, and that reduces the money supply. Now the Fed knows this, so what the Fed does at the beginning of the shopping season is to offset that outflow of currency and that reduction in reserves by buying government bonds. That is, by just creating money out of thin air and purchasing government bonds from the banks. And that injects reserves into the banking system, that open market operation it's called, to offset the reserves that are leaving the banking system through currency. So to make a long story short, I told you that story just to make my point. Any increase in the public's desire to hold currency is going to have a deflationary influence on the money supply that is not controlled by the Fed. I mean, the Fed can react to it, but they don't control it, okay? The public controls it. So Rothbard brings that in to determining what the Fed's intentions are. And secondly, the Fed also in the 1920s did something called discount lending. It loaned to banks directly and charged them the discount rate, okay? But what it did in the 1920s was it charged a very low discount rate, a rate that was below the market rate. So it made it profitable for banks to borrow money at the low discount rate and then to lend that money out at the higher market rate. And that way they earned the difference between the two rates. So banks borrowed from the Fed. So looking at it from the Fed's point of view, the Fed controlled the interest rate. So in controlling the interest rate and making it low, the Fed did control the inflationary influence of that low rate. But on the other hand, they did not control the banks paying the money back. Okay, so whenever the banks were fearful that the future would be uncertain, they would begin to reduce their indebtedness to the banks. That is, they would pay back those loans, okay? The Fed couldn't force them to pay the loans back because the Fed was committed to loaning money anytime the banks wanted to at that lower than market rate. But as I said, the banks controlled how much they paid back. They controlled the level of indebtedness. So that was another uncontrolled deflationary factor, meaning that when banks paid back their loans to the Fed, that reduced their reserves and then that reduced the money supply. So if you take into account those two deflationary factors, okay, public taking currency out of the banks paying back reserves that they borrowed from the Fed, it makes the 1920s appear very differently as regards Fed intent. So if we look at Rothbard and what he says about the intent of the Fed during the 1920s, we find it's very, very inflationary, okay? So now we're including these factors that affect reserves and the money supply, not just the gold stock, which are uncontrolled by the Fed, but also the amount of currency in circulation and the repayment, net repayment of loans to the Fed. Okay, when we include all of those, we find that the from mid-1921, and I have figures there, to the end of 1928, uncontrolled reserves, that is reserves controlled by the public and the banks, fell by 89% or 12% per year. So the Fed, or rather the public and the banks, were deflationary during the 1920s. Okay, their actions would have led to a deflation, given the fractional reserve banking system. But on the other hand, if you look at the Fed, okay, and the things that they control, the reserves they control, they increased by 138% or 18.4% per year, which is a lot different from what Timberlake told us. Timberlake told us that the Fed was deflationary and there was a decrease of 8% per year in what the Fed controlled. Okay, that's certainly not true once you add in currency and repayments. Okay, so the Fed's actions, contrary to Timberlake, and consistent with what Rothbard said, was wildly inflationary during the 1920s. Okay. So now we can look at the Fed's intent during the early 1930s. Okay. Now here we have the monetarist view coming to the forefront. The monetarist view is that the Fed was erroneously and persistently deflationary in the early 1930s, from 1929 to 1933, to be specific. But according, as we'll see, to Rothbard, if you use his interpretation, this deflation, there was a deflation of the money supply, certainly, but it was not caused by the Fed, okay, by Fed's actions. It was caused by the public and the banks, okay? The public and the banks lost faith in the fact that the U.S. could continue to run this phony gold standard that it had, in which the Fed kept manipulating the money supply despite what was happening to the amount of gold coming into or out of the country. So if you look at number one on that on the slide here, what we had happening was from 1929 to 1932, there was an increase in currency as people took currency out of the banks and took gold out of the banks. So there was an increase in currency. There was a fall in the gold stock that the Fed and the banks owned, which meant that reserves were going down. Okay, gold was part of reserves, as was the currency. So the reserves were going down, and that's not controlled by the Fed, and that pushed the money supply down. Okay, also the banks reduced loans to customers because they were fearful that during this recession the customers would never repay these loans, and as a result, that also, they used those reserves to repay, instead of loaning them out, they just simply repaid their loans to the Fed. And as we saw before, when they did that, that reduced reserves, that decreased the money supply. That was not done by the Fed, that was done by the banks themselves. And finally, the banks also held excess reserves. They held more reserves than they were legally required to do. They didn't loan those reserves out. So when they built up excess reserves, as banks have done since 2009, as they built them up, that meant they made fewer loans. And when they made fewer loans, that drove down the money supply. Okay. So the real intent of the Fed was, in fact, we'll get to the next slide, any deflation that occurred during the early 1930s was a result of the public and the banks and their distrust. The public's distrust of the banks and the banks' fear that their loans would not be repaid back. And then here's some figures that you can look at. Basically, from December 29 to December of 1931, there was a huge decrease in reserves and a big decrease in the money supply, okay? But it wasn't caused by the Fed, because if you look at the figures there, the Fed's, there was an increase in controlled reserves controlled by the Fed of about 17% per year. So the Fed was madly trying to inflate the money supply. It was injecting reserves into the system, okay? What caused the deflation was the fact that there were uncontrolled reserves, okay? That is, the public was pulling money out of the banks. The banks weren't lending. They were paying back the Fed, or they were holding excess reserves. So the uncontrolled reserves fell by 27% per year. So it was the public and the banks that were responsible for the deflation, okay? The money supply continued to fall in 32 and 33, but the Fed increased control reserves, okay? It was a fall in uncontrolled reserves and the excess reserves held by the banks that were again responsible. So from 29 to 33, the Fed does not deserve any credit for the monetary deflation, okay, or blame. The monetarists would blame them, but the Austrians would applaud the fact that people were trying to get their property back and that banks were trying to be more careful in their loans. There's nothing wrong with a deflation of the money supply that results from that. And then let me just say a few words about sterilizing the gold, which had a deflationary effect. And that occurred in 1937, 1938. Now, Timberlake blames the Fed for sterilizing the gold standard, which sterilizing gold that was coming into the country. Now, what all that means, sterilizing gold, means it's offsetting the inflow of gold. So as gold is coming in, the Fed is not, it's taking actions that prevents that gold from affecting the money supply. And those actions are, when it's paying dollars out for the gold, it's turning around and it's selling government bonds to get those dollars back so that there is no effect on the money supply. But now here's the problem with that, the idea of Timberlake's, that that's deflationary. First of all, between 1936 and 1938, the U.S. wasn't even on a gold standard. Okay, we went off the gold standard in 1933, and at the same time, made the enormous error of raising the price of gold from $20.67 to $35. But what do you think happened? Now that the price of gold was so much higher than the world price of gold, gold started flooding into the United States. Okay. Now remember, we were no longer on the gold standard. The U.S. dollar was a pure paper money at this point. It was a fiat money. But the Treasury was mandated by law to buy all the gold that flowed into the country. Okay. So this would have caused a massive inflation had the Fed, had the Treasury followed through with this. But they did not. Okay. As I said, this was all offset. This was called the golden avalanche. Okay. So from 34 to 36, they did buy the gold up, and they didn't offset the golden avalanche. And so you saw that the money supply increased tremendously by 14%, 14.8%, and 11.4% during those years. It was in 1937 and 1938 that it reversed this policy, and it no longer, when it bought gold, it offset it by taking those dollars out of circulation. So my take on this, now Rothbard hasn't written on this, other sort of quake that Austrians have written on this. So when the Treasury began to sell government security, sell government bonds, take those dollars out of circulation, it stopped the inflationary effects of buying gold on the money supply. Okay, and this is, you can't call this deflationary because gold was not money. There was no need to buy gold up. Okay, gold is a commodity like anything else. Like anything else the government would buy. If the government were to buy copper or oil or jet planes, there's no reason why you should have an increase in the money supply because the government's buying something, buying some item, okay? And we don't have an increase in the money supply when government buys items like that. Well, the gold at that point was a commodity like any other commodity, and it should not have involved an increase in the money supply. So that was not, there was no deflation because the Fed was not increasing the money supply when gold flowed in. Okay, there was no longer reason to. We were no longer on the gold standard and had not been for 5 years. Okay, and then there's one other controversy. which again, Rothbard really didn't write on, but Timberlake sort of imputes it to the Austrians. You can look at that yourself. It has to do with raising reserve requirements. Okay. So my conclusion is that the Fed's intent was inflationary throughout the Great Depression, except for very brief periods in 1929 and 1936 and 1937, when it was mildly deflationary. Okay, in 36 and 37, not deflationary, disinflationary. In 36 and 37, it raised reserve requirements, which was a way of trying to stop the excess reserves from being put into circulation. That was the last few slides that I did not show you there. And it was also inflationary throughout the 1920s. So I come down on Rothbard's side in this historical controversy. I think that Timberlake has misunderstood some of Rothbard's arguments, as well as unfairly portrayed his motives. I think it's not scholarly to claim that someone is coming up with a certain money supply statistic or making a certain argument because their motives are to make certain facts appear in a certain light. Okay. And it's a good debate. I'm happy that Timberlake, you know, gave me the opportunity to respond to him. But one thing that leaves funny bad taste in my mouth is imputing impure motives to Rothbard. So I'll stop there and I'll take questions.
Okay, so you can just scroll through. Okay. Just make sure that they can't see these, so if you could just read the whole thing.
Okay. Okay, let me just take a few of the questions that have come in. One is, could you elaborate on the concept of needs of trade with regard to the definition of inflation? Are the needs quantifiable in some regard to the money supply? That's a very good question. As the term needs of trade was used by the British Banking School, okay, was an inflationist school during the mid-19th century. The needs of trade was sort of a word that they loosely threw around. It just meant, they basically meant the amount of goods and services that needed to be financed in the economy. And they never really quantified this, okay? But the monetarists and other economists have. Now, they don't call it needs of trade now. They basically talk about the real GDP. Okay, so from a monetarist perspective, if there's an increase, let's say 3% growth in the supply of goods and services in the economy, well then for a monetarist and for most mainstream economists, to avoid deflation, you need to increase the amount of money in the economy by at least 3% so that those extra goods and services that are produced can be financed at the existing price level. Now that's kind of gone by the board now with inflation targeting. So they're saying now that the money supply should increase not just enough to offset any deflationary tendencies in the economy, but certainly enough, but more than that, enough to keep the inflation target enough to meet some sort of inflation target. And they've been talking about so-called lowflation now. And so now Janet Yellen and Paul Krugman and many of the other mainstream economists are worried not just about deflation. Now they're worried about lowflation. They're worried about inflation being 1%, 1.5%. Okay, and so they've coined a new term for this. Okay, and also by the way, Europeans are very worried about lowflation. But their inflation has dipped below 1%. It's been 0.9% or 0.8%. Okay. So needs of trade is more sophisticated in today's world. It is quantified through the real GDP figure. Okay. I also might add that in addition to the amount of goods and services in the economy, monetarists and mainstream economists, and even free banking economists like Larry White and George Selgin believe that there should be an increase in the amount of money in the economy whenever there's an increase from, in the amount of money that people want to hold. Okay, even if there's no increase in the amount of goods and services in the economy, people might want to hold more money because they're uncertain or fearful about the future. And in this case, there should also be an increase in money supply, it's argued. So you really can't call that an need of trade. Okay, the need of trade really refers to, as I said, the real GDP in the economy. Okay. Someone asks, could you compare what happened in the 1920s with controlled and uncontrolled reserves with how the banks in 2010 with TARP money have accumulated excess reserves and not lent the money out? What can we expect that may be similar or different to the 1920s? Okay, it's true now we have excess reserves, and that's keeping the money supply from increasing by more than it is already doing. Okay, now, not lending money and holding excess reserves certainly keeps the money supply from increasing. But the banks are lending and they are buying government bonds. Okay, so whether you lend or buy government bonds, that puts more money into circulation. So the money supply is not decreasing because of these excess reserves. It's increasing. We do not have a deflation. Okay. In fact, the Fed is actually paying banks to keep excess reserves. So what it's doing is it's paying 0.25% per year for banks to keep their money idle. As long as our economy doesn't isn't performing very well, banks may as well take the riskless 0.25% and let their money sit idle in the accounts at the Fed rather than loan it out and risk losing money by lending it to businesses that are that may be shaky. Okay. And there's no reason to put it in government treasury bills because the treasury bill rate is less than 0.25%. So there is money that is being, our reserves are being lent out. The Fed is keeping a lot rather banks are keeping a lot of excess reserves though because of the state of the economy. Now, if the Fed removes the payment, the interest that it's paying on keeping money idle, on keeping excess reserves, then you're going to see that money being lent out. But what they want to do is, I forget what some kind of a strategy to disengage from all these excess reserves. Somehow to get these excess reserves out from the banking system as the banks go back to lending. So until they figure out a disengagement strategy, the Fed is going to keep paying interest on those idle excess reserves. Okay, let me look at the next question. Someone says here, also with companies like Apple holding huge cash reserves, how is that affecting the money supply? When a company holds cash reserves, they don't actually hold like dollars, you know, in their vaults or anything like that. They don't put the money under their, you know, in their floorboards or anything. Cash simply means holding government bonds, things that are highly liquid, okay? T-bills, money market mutual funds, and money market mutual funds are not cash. They're not part of the money supply. They're invested in very short-term, high-grade financial instruments. So money market mutual accounts are invested in commercial paper. They're invested in bank certificates of deposit, 3 months, 6 months, and they're invested in government T-bills, 3 month T-bills. So when it's said that companies are sitting on a pile of cash, they don't mean that they're actually holding money, that they're actually holding it in their checking account or holding currency. Okay, they're holding it in very short-term financial instruments and earning some interest on it. Okay, and those instruments are not part of the money supply. So to answer your question, it doesn't really have any effect on the money supply. And if you look at, by the way, at the slide that I put up on what's included in the true money supply, we do not include money market mutual fund shares in the true money supply. Because they're just shares of ownership in, not in cash, okay, not in quantities of currency, but they're shares of ownership in commercial paper and other financial instruments. Technically, and it has happened, money market mutual funds could break the buck, meaning that your share is worth less than a dollar. okay? Because some company that you've invested in has defaulted on its financial instruments, its debts. Okay. How does the increase in excess reserves show up in the reserve statistics? If you look at the St. Louis Fed, okay, they have a great database. You can see the difference between required reserves and the excess reserves. Okay, so you can just simply look it up and you can see the statistics. So that's the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis. Okay, so you would go to that website. Here's a question. Do you think that the 1919, the Mobile Law that forced mutual aid societies to increase reserve requirements, did this have an effect on the money supply by inflating it by increasing bank reserves? I'm not familiar with that law, but increasing bank reserves has the opposite effect on the money supply. Okay, so increasing bank reserves means instead of holding $1 for every $10 of deposits, that's 10%, which is the legal minimum today in the U.S. If the Fed suddenly said you had to hold $2 for every $10, that's 20%, then that would actually decrease the money supply. Banks would have to scramble to lend less and to reduce the amount of checking deposits that they're holding because to meet that requirement. Someone asked here, how does Selgin and George Selgin and Larry White differ from Rothbard and Timberlake? Very good question. They differ from Timberlake in that they're closer to Timberlake than they are to Rothbard in their explanation of the Great Depression. They do believe that the 1920s may have been inflationary because they do believe in the Austin business cycle theory. But they think that would have, only a mild recession would have resulted, and that what made it worse was the deliberate intention of the Fed to decrease the money supply or to allow it to decrease. Okay, so they blame the Fed for being deflationary. So they accept half the Rothbardian view and half Timberlake's view. Okay, they believe that the Great Depression was a result of deflation. Okay. But they believe that the 1920s were an inflationary decade. I hope I'm not putting words in their mouth. They do accept the Austin business cycle theory, so I'm pretty sure that they would agree with Rothbard in the 1920s. But they certainly do not agree with him on the 1930s. Okay. Okay. I have a question here that says I'm confused about the impact of the golden avalanche. If gold not money, then how did the Treasury purchase of this gold increase the money supply, and why wouldn't subsequent selling of bonds be deflationary? Okay, so that's a good question. Even though gold's not money, let's forget about gold. Let's say the Treasury decides to purchase copper, okay, and that it does so as it did back then by having the Fed create the dollars that are used to purchase the copper. Okay, so by creating bank accounts to purchase that copper, that would be increasing the money supply. Okay, so as long as you increase the money supply to purchase anything, and that's what the Fed does right now, right? When it buys government securities or mortgage-backed loans, it does so by simply creating bank reserves out of thin air, paying the banks for those financial assets, and the banks then have those reserves to lend out. If it were to buy copper from somebody, it would write a check on itself, okay? And again, this was done by the Treasury, but the Treasury was doing it using money created by the Fed. So in creating that new money and paying with that new money to, let's say, a copper producer, the copper producer would then take that check, put it in a bank. The bank would now have, let's say, $1 million more reserves, and it could loan that money out, and there would be multiple expansion of the money supply. Okay, so whether gold was money or not is immaterial at that point. As long as gold was purchased by money that was created by the Fed via the Treasury, that increases the money supply. Okay, So to reverse that, and as I did in 37-38, to reverse that by having open market purchases, open market sales, that is to take government bonds that the Fed owns and to sell them back to the public and take those dollars out of circulation, that is not deflationary. That just prevents the inflation that would have occurred and that did occur during the first part of the golden avalanche, okay, by buying gold with created money. See if I missed any questions here. Is it possible to have rising asset prices without rising consumer prices? That's an interesting question, and history is telling us that, yeah, it certainly is. In fact, we did in the 1920s. We had a big stock market expansion, but as run-up. We had a bull market, a boom in the 1920s in the stock market and in real estate, and yet consumer prices, wholesale prices were very stable. So it's certainly possible. And, of course, that also happened in the 1990s during the tech bubble, the high-tech bubble, or sometimes called the dot-com bubble. We had a big run-up in the stock market, which then later crashed in 1999, 2000. But yet prices rose very moderately from about 1993 or 94 on. Consumer prices, I think they started off rising by about 5% a year at the beginning of the 90s. By the end of the 90s, they're rising by 2% per year. Okay. And of course, from 2002 or so onward to 2006, we had a run up in housing prices and in stock prices and very moderate consumer price inflation. And this goes along with the Austrian business cycle theory in that when you inject money into the credit market, when the Fed injects new money, it goes to banks and through the credit markets. In order to loan the new money out, the banks must lower the interest rate to get people to borrow that new money, to get people who are interested in mortgage loans, to get businesses that are interested in investing in additional plant and equipment, and to get people who want to purchase or get loans to purchase stocks and so on. So the interest rate goes down, and interest-sensitive assets go up in price as a result, okay? And that includes stocks, bonds, and so on. What are, if any, the challenges unanswered or areas yet to be explored that a new economist can contribute to the understanding of the Great Depression or the 1920s within the Rothbardian tradition or the economics field as a whole? Okay. Well, I think more work can be done on the 1930s. There's an economist, a mainstream economist named Leo Hanian, very eminent macroeconomist that has now taken Rothbard's line about the 1930s. And what he says, and again, you might want to Google him and look, some of his articles are online, and they're fairly easy to read. I mean, there's not a lot of mathematical economics in them or econometrics. But what he basically says is that it was a failure of the labor market, not a failure of the Fed, that caused the deflation, that caused a depression of the early 1930s. Okay, so what do I mean by that? Or what does Ohanian mean by that? What he means is that the money supply shrunk, but which is true, but had prices even fell mildly, and especially wages, there would have been re-equilibration, okay, a new equilibrium at which businesses would have been able to earn profit, and the depression would have ended much earlier, or the Great Depression itself may not have even begun. We would have had a recession that ended, you know, much earlier. Let me write his name here for you. You might want to look him up, Lee Ohanian. Okay, if you can see that, it's his name. Okay. And I'm trying to think. I wrote an article in which I talked about his even see his citation of Rothbard, he even cites Rothbard's America's Great Depression. Okay. And evidently it's caused a lot of controversy because a lot of mainstream economists are now attacking him for this view. But as I said, there's more to be done in the 1930s. Okay. In 1933, why did the government pay $35 per ounce of gold when world price is 20? What were the political reasons to pay a premium and such a high premium? Okay, what the U.S. government wanted to do was it wanted to devalue its currency. And so you devalue your currency. As Mises pointed out, devaluation was just a technique to increase the amount of money in circulation. So the government knew that if it increased the price of gold, okay, it would disguise the inflation. So what would happen is if they increased the price of gold, it knew that there would be a golden avalanche coming in, that a lot of gold would come to the U.S., and that it could buy up that gold, and it did that for three or four years. It could buy up that gold, and buying up that gold, it would create new money. And in creating new money, it would raise the price level, and it would cause our dollar to be worth less on foreign markets in relation to other currencies. And by pushing the value of our dollar down, the exchange rate, having our exchange rate depreciate, it means that our goods are less expensive, and therefore there'd be more exports of U.S. goods. So in other words, if you had to pay, if you could get $35 for an ounce of gold instead of only $20, it's cheaper to buy goods. So, you know, if something costs $20, or let's say something costs $15, at $20 you can, let's say $20, all you need is 1 ounce of gold, and you need 1 ounce of gold to get that item, okay? But at $35, then you get $35 for an ounce of gold. So you have $20 to buy that item, and you have $15 left over to buy something else in the U.S., okay? And so that would increase U.S. exports. And they were hoping to put U.S. workers back to work. But of course, what they didn't realize was what's good for the goose is good for the gander, meaning that if the U.S. did it, other countries began to do it. Okay? So they responded in kind, and that's called a currency war. They increased their money supply. They devalued their currencies and increased their money supply to push the value of their currency down. So the U.S. didn't gain much of an advantage. All that happened was that throughout the 30s, we had this currency wars. And at the end, there was hardly any international trade or international investment because people were so uncertain about what the values of the different currencies would be worth. I'm just looking to see if there are any other questions I have not addressed. Okay, thank you very much for tuning in. And Bob Murphy will be here next week to lecture. And I'll be back the week after to lecture on inflation, deflation, good and bad. And I think that'll be a real eye-opener for you. So I look forward to your attendance. Have a good night.